Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us today. Hope you had a wonderful, wonderful weekend, especially those of you who had to work at some point over the weekend. Not everybody gets those glorious four-day holiday weekends. Not everyone gets those government holiday four-day things. How about you, Lyle?
I did. It was wonderful.
You get the four-day thing?
Oh, yes. We're living that nonprofit lifestyle. We get it easy.
I don't know. I was going to introduce our glorious guest, Lyle Sola Yates, but let me make you wait a minute.
Thank you.
Anyway, happy Thanksgiving to everyone, and hopefully you're as thankful as I am. I'm thankful for Sunday today because yesterday was almost sleet day. Anyway, back to our guest today. We're going to be talking about city neighborhoods, about poverty, the difference in what just living across a street can do for folks. Our guest, Lyle Sola Yates from the Charlottesville City Planning Commission. Thank you for being with us today as your four-day weekend winds down.
Delighted. Best way I could possibly wrap it up.
Yeah, a little work for you.
It's fine.
Even for the hour. Again, Lyle Sola Yates, Charlottesville City Planning Commission. That's not your job, though, is it?
That's a hobby. That's just a little hustle I've got going.
What brought you to Charlottesville's Planning Commission?
Sure. We're right now, the city's in the middle of the comprehensive planning process. It's a big thing we have to do. The state requires it. Every 5 years, we look through all of our plans, update them, see what's missing, see what needs to be changed. And I was sort of monitoring this as a citizen of the 10th and Page neighborhood. And I was really concerned about what I saw in the plan. It looked like they wanted to, during an affordable housing crisis, when things are looking pretty bleak for a lot of people, it seemed like they wanted to provide less homes. And that sent me into a panic, and I got very upset. And I started contacting city councilors saying, you can't do this. This is bad. You know, put me on the planning commission. I'll try and fix it. And they did, which was very nice of them.
How can you provide less homes in a city neighborhood that isn't near anywhere where they're going to put like a big three or four lane road?
Right. That's what concerned me. So it's something called down zoning. So in zoning, that's a land use regulation that cities set that say how many homes you're allowed to build, what they look like, how far they're set back from the road, how much yard space they need, all the kind of regulations that make up the city that you see. Those numbers can change. And my fear was that those numbers were going low when they needed to go higher.
All right. Well, we're going to be learning about zoning today. We're also going to be learning about income and how these things deal with poverty. Now, you mentioned the neighborhood that you live in.
Oh, yes. 10th and Page.
10th and Page. A neighborhood that Wake Up Call has talked about before with Jordy Yeager. He wrote an article about that. Mm-hmm. You can find that on SevillePodcast.com, as you can with all of our programs. Quite a fascinating article. Did you choose to live in 10th and Page?
You know, my wife and I had a long talk about it. We thought we were Belmont people. You know, Belmont had sort of
a
very fashionable, very cool. You know, it had a good buzz about it. But we actually drove there one night after work, and realized just, you know, that was so brutal. And we thought, well, could we do this every day? Could we, you know, drive out to Belmont every day in traffic? And we just agreed, no, that can't be us. So then we changed our whole look on things.
So if Belmont had something negative about it that made you vote against it, what about 10th and Page was positive that made you vote for it?
Well, still beautiful, still relatively affordable, but for us, just the location is spectacular. You know, you're right in the middle of things. There's services, there's grocery stores, there's restaurants, there's things to do. You're right in the middle of things. I fell in love.
Okay. So again, our guest today, Lyle Soley-Yates, on Charlottesville's Planning Commission, as we talk about planning, city neighborhoods, and something that a lot of folks don't often think about, and the income for the folks who live in the neighborhoods and the poverty that can sometimes go with that. Let's start from a historical aspect, Lyle. Redlining. Tell us about redlining, and if you will, take us up to William Levitt.
Sure. Actually, that's a really good way to think about it. So redlining starts, a fellow named Hoyt. His main concern is how do you best make residential property an investment that you can really rely on, a secure, reliable investment. We're not talking about a quality home. We're not talking about a good place to raise kids. We're talking about a way to really get that money out of it reliably, how to protect it as a speculative asset. And he has a lot of ideas, and that becomes encoded in these guidelines for how to underwrite mortgages, for how to insure them. It becomes this whole system. Then when the Great Depression hits and the federal government is trying to figure out, like, okay, how do we get back? How do we start building houses again? They go to Hoyt, and they go to those regulations, thinking, like, well, obviously, we've got this ready to go. Let's just use these rules. So what we need is, you know, large lots, single-family homes, detached. The way that it was set up is that for existing areas like Charlottesville is mostly older than these regulations. They had to say, well, okay, we can't build these according to the new regulations because it's already there. So how do we classify it? How do we go back and say what's good and what's bad? So they said, well, what looks like what we want? What's, you know, large lot, single-family? And for them, they were very concerned about race. They wanted to see, like, okay, 100% white, mixed race, and they sort of classified it, even if it was 100% white, but they thought there was a chance that things could change. They would mark that, and it would be, you'd get a B instead of an A. And really, only the most secure, the most protected economically, racially, those that would get the best treatment, the lowest rates, the best insurance, the most money flowing into it from the federal government.
So redlining, if you're on, the redlining is the divider?
Yes, exactly. It's a literal map, color-coded, where you can actually find your house and say, oh, okay, in the 40s, the government thought this about my neighborhood. Richmond had one. Charlottesville didn't. We basically ended up having to pay to create our own, just because the federal government was limited in how many they could produce. So they just did it for big areas like Roanoke. And you can all look up all of these. So for us, we ended up having to pay Harlan Bartholomew Associates to create our own redlining map. And then that guided those decisions.
So what percentage of cities, let's not talk specifically about Charlottesville yet, but if you had a city like Richmond, what percentage of the city fell on the side of the map, on the side of the red line that the government wanted to get an A, and the side of the red line that the government said, let's not worry about them yet?
Richmond didn't do very well. Looking at the map, there were a few areas that were colored green and that would get good treatment, but a lot of it was red. A lot of Richmond just would not get any funding at all, which was a real problem that actually, you know, dried up the resources that Richmond had to take care of itself and rebuild and build new housing. whereas a place like, I believe, Lynchburg had a lot more green.
Why is that for Richmond?
Richmond had a whole lot of African Americans and a lot of poverty. A lot of higher density development. So think of like a duplex or like a small apartment building. And that just wouldn't qualify. They had a lot of small lots, which actually now that's fashionable. Now that's, you know, walker friendly and attractive. But back then that was considered dangerous because it was more affordable to lower income people.
And so the, excuse me, the line was based on how the housing already was?
Exactly. Based on what was there and who was there.
So if we go to a city like Lynchburg, they had a higher percentage of green on the map?
Correct. Lynchburg, they did have some African Americans there and some older housing, but by the, actually probably because it was just land was cheaper there, they had a lot more single family detached large lot homes compared to Richmond. So for their size, they were considered to be much more attractive.
And once you got a green area on your map, what was happening to that?
You were getting money. You were getting federally guaranteed loans, low interest rates, you know, and all the benefits that come from getting that cheap money. So there was redevelopment. People were, you know, taking care of their homes. New homes were going in. Things were good.
If you were on the red part of the map, you were, which was only African American
or mixed. It could also be in some areas it could be Asian American or Native American.
Were you not getting any money? Were you getting high cost money? What was happening?
Right, you had to find other ways. The federal government wasn't there for you. So some people actually went to Sears and got financing through Sears. Otherwise, or other catalogs, or you could make private deals. Or actually, one thing that would happen is you would get a white buyer who would negotiate a loan for one of these areas, still at a higher interest rate, but they at least they could get into the bank. They would get service, and then they could turn around and make a private loan, just sort of acting as a middleman.
Again, our guest today is Lyle Soley-Yates from the Charlottesville Planning Commission as we talk about city neighborhoods and poverty. When this redlining, when the drawing of the maps started, before anybody received any money, would these families have the same amount of money and the government give them the funding, or did you already have more or less money?
That's a great question. So the world was very different then. This is before the middle class. This is before the post-war boom. We're coming out of the Great Depression and World War II. There are some people with enormous amounts of wealth, but generally America is poor at this time. You know, regardless of race, you're not doing very well. So this was a leg up for a lot of people, and it was handed out based on race and service status.
Goodness. So we're finding that in 1920s, 1930s, that the federal government is being racist and setting things off at what sounds like a blistering pace of making quite a difference in how we're moving forward at helping one class and severely hurting another.
Exactly right. It was picking winners and losers. And if you were a winner, it was transformative. It changed your world. It created intergenerational wealth that really, you know, created this country that we know now. But if you weren't, it didn't.
Was there any one or two people or sets of the government who made these choices and said, this is how we need to do it?
Yes, the Federal Housing Administration. They really did the work here of making the maps and administering the program and making sure that everything went exactly in the way that they wanted.
Was that the decision of somebody? I mean, can you attach a name to that? If I went back in my textbook, am I going to associate somebody with that?
I would say it probably goes back to Hoyt. But there were many people who were sort of in the in between making it work. It was really Hoyt's vision.
And tell me, who is William Levitt?
William Levitt was a very clever man. He figured out how to get as much of this federal money out of the government as possible. He created what we think of as the modern suburb, doing exactly what the federal government told him to do, which was large lot, single family, detached, residential only communities. Attractive and incredibly affordable, just because they were so perfectly optimized to pull that money out of the federal government and turn it into attractive, you know, decent housing.
I don't know. Tell me more. I don't know. I mean, I want to be able to go home and tell my wife the story of William Levitt.
Sure. So Mr. Levitt was in New York City, and New York City at this time is nightmarish. Think of slums. Think of tenements. It's dangerous. There are fires. It's dirty. It smells. Everything is dingy because it's smoky. It's a pretty horrific place. It's not the pretty, shiny New York City we know today. It's a place of enormous poverty. It's a place of there's still a lot of industry there. And it was a very attractive idea to not be there, to be able to work there and then retreat, raise a family out in the country, clean air, with the white picket fence and the large green lot. What we know today as fairly normal was radical then and seductive.
Again, our guest is Lyle Sola Yates. He's on Charlottesville's Planning Commission, and we're learning about city neighborhoods and poverty. So how did William Levitt turn this into income for himself?
So Levitt was a genius. He figured out all the programs and how they worked, and then he became the middleman for so that you could sign up with him, and he would take care of all of the paperwork, he would take care of everything, and all you had to worry about was the monthly payment to Mr. Levitt. It was spectacular service. And he had different products, but they were all roughly similar. You know, no matter what you got, it was pretty decent with all the modern conveniences, everything that was popular at the time, electric living. And he made it easy.
But he only made it doable for one class.
Yes, the new, brand new, what would be lower middle class, white only, generally about the same age, young people, veterans, fresh from the war.
Why only for the lower middle class?
Well, very wealthy people didn't need this. They, you know, financing was unnecessary to them. They had the money. Very poor people couldn't afford it anyway. They were stuck. So this was an opportunity only for those who could make the payments. But if you were a veteran and white, you could make the payments.
Were there different ways? He was in New York?
Yes.
Was there someone similar in a different region of the country? If I left New York and I came to Maryland, did I find someone in Maryland who was doing this? Did he have a copycat, or was he copying someone in a different region of every part of the country?
Yes, Levittown was incredibly popular and successful and influential. As soon as this was done, it was a race to make it happen all across the country.
When I did my homework for today's show, what I did find was that there were just different ways of creating poverty for African Americans, mostly. But I'll ask the question early on, were there different ways of, were we also creating poverty for whites?
Yes. So the original intention, as far as I can tell, was to create sort of a caste system similar to what we had before the Civil War, with white people somewhat safe and somewhat protected. But as time moved on and things became more expensive and difficult, yes, low-income whites started to fall into that same poverty trap and get stuck there. That wasn't, as far as I could tell, that wasn't the intent. but that's just what happened.
All right. Our guest today is Lyle Solo Yates. Poverty in city neighborhoods, our topic today. Hang tight. A lot more information for the hour, and we're going to get into Charlottesville pretty quickly. Be right back. All right. I hope you're enjoying this beautiful Sunday after that really wet and cold Saturday. Enjoy them while you can. So we are here with Lyle Solo Yates, Charlottesville's Planning Commission. We're talking about poverty in the neighborhoods, a lot of which has to do with your skin color.
Quite a bit.
And this all, I mean, we can go all the way back to slavery, Civil War, but what we're talking about at the moment happens all based on housing in at the Great Depression and some choices that the government made. Harlan Bartholomew. Tell me the story about Harlan Bartholomew.
Harlan Bartholomew is the boogeyman of urban planning. We don't like to talk about him because he's embarrassing. He used to be celebrated as the dean of urban planners. He was the father. He was the creator. He figured it all out, and he popularized it worldwide. He was he proselytized the world to do what we would think of as modern, city building. So that's zoning. That's everything you see, everything you think of when you think of urban planning, that pretty much all goes back to Harlan Bartholomew.
You said, so what did he do that qualifies him as the boogeyman?
Many things.
Give me three.
So Harlan Bartholomew is starting in 1915, and his head is very much in 1915, which we were a very different country then. We were divided. So the big thing, the big question in 1915 that progressive reformers are talking about is, how do we do slum clearance? How do we be like England? How do we be like Paris? How do we, get these poor people out and make things nice? And he had some ideas about that. So that's what brought him to St. Louis was his ideas for how best to do slum clearance. You might know this by a different name, urban renewal. The idea being just, okay, identify where people of low income, people of color, where they're living, find ways to raise money, buy the land, tear everything down, put in something nice, maybe a park, maybe a government building, maybe a highway, to change the city to be cleaner, to be more efficient, more sanitary, what was called the white city or the city efficient.
So what is he, if he must have, I don't even know where to go with that because it all sounds
big.
So he's doing these things in what manner?
So he's a bureaucrat. He's interested in how to create government documents to leverage large amounts of private and government capital to make changes in cities. So he works in something like 150 different cities, the entire state of Hawaii. The city of Charlottesville, Vancouver, Seattle, Hollywood. These are just the ones that I've looked into. There's, the numbers are countless. St. Louis, like crazy. St. Louis was his laboratory. East St. Louis, of course, that whole region. The South especially, but really the whole country and Canada.
So, I mean, what is he doing? I mean, he slum clearance.
Yes.
Okay.
So the basic idea is you chart out a plan, and he made many of these, including for Charlottesville, where you draw on a map exactly what the conditions are. And that's by physically going to a place, noting who's there, what's there. Are the buildings in good repair? Are the lots big or are they small? Are the buildings single-family detached, like Hoyt would have wanted, or are they apartment buildings that could be maybe a sign of lower-income people being able to come in? Are the roofs in good repair? Are people painting them? Are people taking care of the lawns? Noting all of this down, mapping it all, and from that determining who gets to keep their home and who does not.
Okay, so he finds the ones that he doesn't like, and how does he move forward?
So that changed over time. In the early days, it was really hard because he would have to go to...
Because he didn't have a Google car to send around to do the work for him.
Exactly. He would physically have to go, him and the people in his organization, Harlan Bartholomew Associates, would have to physically go and chart it out, which was a lot of work. Though it actually, having done that work, they got a lot of prestige because they knew things, and knowing things was a big deal in the teens and 20s. This is before computers or any of that. So just being able to say, oh, I know, very impressive. It gave him power. But money was a huge problem. This is something they ran into in St. Louis over and over and over. They would count up exactly how much money it would cost to do all this work. And then they would go to the voters and say, hey, let's raise taxes. And the voters would say, no, you're a monster. We're never going to raise taxes for that. That sounds terrible. So that it just never worked. And they tried over and over, and it never worked. So eventually what he came to is that you have to go to the federal government. They're the only ones with a big enough piggy bank to do this kind of work. So that's how we've got the first two big housing bills through Congress to ostensibly to build housing, but actually to do slum clearance.
So he wants to clear 5 city blocks. How does he do it?
So first you make the map, mapping out exactly who stays and who doesn't. And it's generally following along a redlining map. It's very similar. Then that goes into an application, which just like the one we did for Charlottesville in 1956, just saying exactly what we intend to do, how much money it's going to cost. It's a sort of a full project plan with a budget. Then you submit that to the Housing and Urban Development Department at the federal level. And it goes against other communities who are trying to do the same thing, and they determine who wins based on, you know, their criteria. And if you win the money, you get to do urban renewal.
But how do you get the people out?
I see. So that initial expense is generally covered by the locality. So I think we paid $75,000 for it. But if you win the money, then that you get reimbursed. So it's like free money.
Okay, but are those buildings empty?
No, these are occupied homes. People are living in these homes.
Right. So what do you do? I mean, if I'm living in that house, in that block, where do I go? How do you make me move?
That was a huge problem. So depending on which project we're talking about, and there were many, there might be replacement housing or there might not. If there's replacement housing, you know, you're okay. It's probably going to be subsidized. It's probably going to be relatively affordable.
Right, except that you're forcing me to pick up and move.
You are being forced. That's right. So everything you know, everyone you know,
and if there's not replacement housing?
You are out of luck.
The government just says, sorry, for some reason, real or made up, we're tearing down your building.
Yes, that's
because
correct.
We're going to put a park here, or the government really needs to put our building here.
Correct, and whoever the owner is will get compensated. But
I'm not the owner.
Correct, you get nothing. You lose.
Lyle Sola Yates here, 29 minutes after the hour, as we talk about city neighborhoods and ways that many people are being screwed. Tell me about, is this blockbusting? Is this what's called blockbusting?
So blockbusting is a little bit of a different idea. I haven't proven that this happened in Charlottesville, although I suspect it did. Blockbusting is sort of the other side of this, which is either mixed race or majority white neighborhoods that are suddenly feel that they are in danger of rapidly losing their value, low-income people of color are going to move in. It's going to be a disaster. Sell now. It's a manipulative tactic that was used. I've got it in Richmond back in the 20s, but it's more common in the 50s. It was huge in New York. Actually, organized crime got really involved in it. Providing arbitrage between white homeowners and generally lower-income African-American homeowners, though it could be... various immigrant groups.
We keep touching on Charlottesville, tell me about the 1929 zoning fight in Charlottesville.
This is fascinating to me. This is the main thing I'm researching right now. So we had zoning in Virginia fairly early on. I think we were one of the first to do it. We started with what was called racial zoning, which was a very simple saying. If you're a white person, you cannot move to a majority African-American area. If you're an African-American person, you cannot move to a majority white area. If you're either, you can't move into a mixed race area. Mixed race areas will be destroyed. These were sort of this was the basic idea of segregation law. I think Virginia was the first to do this. We actually did it before it was legal, but Richmond rushed to make it legal. But we were almost immediately sued, and that went to the Virginia Supreme Court. They said it was fine. Appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Buchanan versus Worley. The U.S. Supreme Court said it was not fine. The Virginia Supreme Court was wrong, and segregation was illegal. And then we had to start over.
Here we are in Charlottesville in 2018. I don't even know. Some of this stuff, it just blows my mind. We go back to where we started the show, talking about what the government has had done in assisting one race and not helping the other. And you mentioned how this had, by helping one race back in, helping whites back in the early 1930s and providing them with money and homes, and this would help from your grandparents on down, and putting blacks at a disadvantage from your grandparents on down. And you've heard the story about, well, we settled all this and helped even things out in 1968, correct?
1968. So that would be segregation is knocked down. We have equal rights officially. We did do a lot then. I think that's under Nixon. We almost got it. We got schools desegregated. That was big. We got parks desegregated. That was big. Equal right to vote. A lot of the Jim Crow laws go down by then or a little bit before, which is wonderful. One thing we don't do is housing. There were efforts at the federal level to desegregate housing at that time. Nixon found out about it and he killed it. The threat was that communities that didn't affirmatively act to end segregation would no longer get federal subsidies, which was a pretty scary thing, maybe even highway money, which localities need that money. They depend on it. So being able to threaten taking that away would force action. It would force efforts to end segregation. But Nixon did not like that.
And you sent me a link to something that was meant to be sort of, it was meant to be comedy, but it points out that housing has to do with schools and the how they are tied together, and schools remain because of property taxes pay for schools. That the financial disparity also keeps the schools somewhat segregated or quite segregated just because of the financial problems.
Right. Segregation in housing created by all these programs that we've talked about helped to create spatial segregation in public schools. There's sort of something we all kind of know in America is that suburban schools are better than urban schools. The reason is it's more expensive to buy a home in suburban areas. That's not accessible to low-income people, by and large. So those schools don't have those people, and therefore they are perceived as being nicer. The people there have more resources, have access to more to learn, which creates opportunities that many people don't get. It's unfair.
Lyle Soley Yates from Charlottesville's Planning Commission. Tell me for a few minutes about the Planning Commission, and how does the Planning Commission deal with some of these things that we've been talking about? When you, or let's start actually at the beginning. What does the Planning Commission plan in Charlottesville?
A very good place to start. The Planning Commission is fairly old. I think it starts around the 30s or 40s. We started with zoning, administering land use regulations, and people's concerns about them, how to make changes, how to get what they wanted built, whether or not.
Are you planning in the 1930s that I don't have an African-American live next to me?
Our maps from that time do have segregated parks listed, and there's pretty clear race lines according to where the tightest residential restrictions are in 1929.
Okay. So, and let's move forward to 2018.
Moving forward, we continue with that. In the 1950s, we made a bunch of changes working with Harlan Bartholomew to try and restrict housing a little bit more and accommodate all the land that the Charlottesville had sort of gobbled up from the city or gobbled up from the county. We'd been expanding pretty regularly since then, and just dealing with, you know, new changes, cars. Cars were big in the 20s, but in the 50s they were everything. Streetcars were gone by then. Buses became a major concern. Industry was huge, which is kind of hard to imagine now, but industry was a major topic, a major strategic concern. But still, we were doing zoning. We were doing a lot of the sort of land use instruments that we use today. Moving forward, we started to get into design review, starting the downtown mall. There's a glass building on the downtown mall that had a little bit of politics attached to it. Starting there, we began to, if people wanted to do a building that maybe was in a sensitive area, historic area, it would go before the Board of Architectural Review, who would help them determine if it would be fit in well with the history or the character of the area.
And so here we are in, you know, 2000s. What is this Planning Commission doing now?
We are still in our comprehensive plan that got me so fired up a year ago. We are almost done. We are submitting to the city council in their December meeting. Actually, we're not quite done. We're missing the land use chapter and the public engagement chapter. But everything else is there. Our major concern coming out of the events of August 12th and sort of the issues that we've been struggling with and really starting to understand our history and think more critically about what we're doing. Has been to sort of go back and say, well, what do we do now? So we've been made some changes to the land use map to be a little bit more equitable, to introduce more housing into areas that can offer more opportunity, not just the orange dot. There was an orange dot report showing that poverty is very concentrated in the center of the city. That's actually a bad thing. People should have the ability to go to where there is opportunity. So one of the ideas of this plan is to provide that, as well as overall to provide more housing to address the shortage.
Lyle Soley Yates here, our guest today from Charlottesville's Planning Commission. Hang tight, because we're going to come back and we want to talk about how kids from poor families in certain neighborhoods have a lot less opportunity to earn some money than kids in poor families in other neighborhoods. Why is that? Don't go anywhere. All right, I'm back.
Lyle, you back?
I am back.
All right. Good to have you. So real quick, follow up on the Planning Commission. Some people have talked about how many hotels Charlottesville can possibly have in the city. How many more hotels can possibly be had in this city?
Many more. We have two big issues, and both of them round up to UVA. There is tremendous demand for hotel space in this region because of UVA, because of graduation, because of, you know, all the events, the weddings. There's so much. For our size, it's absolutely ridiculous, and it seems ridiculous, but that's real. The other thing is UVA organizes events. They organize huge, you know, regional, national, global events, and they don't do it here because the spaces, well, they do some, but the big stuff they don't do here because the spaces aren't big enough. We can't hold that kind of that scale of an event, and UVA wants to. So it will happen. The question is, how do we make that work for us?
All right. So I touched on the kids from poor families in certain neighborhoods versus kids from poor families in other neighborhoods. Is research done from something called the Opportunity Atlas?
Yes, indeed. Raj Chetty, pretty amazing researcher. The big idea is to looking at old census records, focusing on actually people about my age, sort of mid-30s, and looking back at how they did, controlling for income, so comparing the same groups by income, and then splitting up by race, and then looking at different places. So the idea is, does where you grow up affect how you do in life, like how much money you make, if you have a child very early in life, if you go to jail? And the answer is yes. Same person, different place, different life.
So if you had grown up in one neighborhood under the same family, how much money you ended up making, where you ended up being, would have made a difference if in that same setup you had grown up in a poorer neighborhood or a wealthier neighborhood.
That's what the data suggests, which I found shocking. I suspected it was true, but I didn't expect it would be so big and so strong.
You care to give us some examples of neighborhoods?
Sure.
In Charlottesville?
Looking specifically at Charlottesville, so thinking of West Haven, if you want to grow up low income but end up doing, you know, making a pretty high income, West Haven is not a good place to start. You're probably going to end up right back where you
now
started.
Why is that? I mean, what is it about the specific neighborhood, not specifically about West Haven, but what about your neighborhood plays a role in your income as an adult, where you end up?
You know, talking to my neighbors in 10th and Page, this is actually where I live, the main thing I keep hearing is their children say, you know, we just can't make it here. If we want to, you know, get a job, if we want to, you know, live, we can't do it here in Charlottesville. We have to go to Richmond, to Northern Virginia, to Norfolk, places where we can build a life.
But what's the difference between West Haven neighborhood and what's one of the other ones I found here, and the Willow Heights neighborhood?
Ooh, remind me where Willow Heights is?
And I don't know.
Ha!
Locust Grove.
Locust
neighborhood.
Grove. Locust Grove is fascinating. That's where we see the highest opportunity for low-income people. I suspect because it's so diverse. We have a lot of jobs there, a lot of blue-collar jobs, also a lot of affordable housing, and a lot of high-end housing. So we get some mixing, which is probably really good. Low-income people are getting exposed to people who aren't like them, people who have different experiences, different influences, and just a different view on things and access to capital. having that exposure can change your life.
Do you think that's what it is? Is instead of being feeling run down on a daily basis, and I'll use that phrase, you maybe when you get off the bus stop, you have somebody next to you who doesn't feel run down, or that you have a house next door with a different job than somebody at the house next door. Somebody who doesn't work at UVA versus somebody who might have their own job, even if that own job might be. And I know that I'm going to stereotype here. But, you know, a lot of people who work near UVA, and this goes back to that Orange Dot project, so I'm not making things up, but a lot of the neighborhoods near UVA, and West Haven falls into that, work hourly jobs at UVA, cleaning, and doing similar jobs like that. So somebody getting off the bus or walking home from school at West Haven may have a parent who does cleaning at UVA, but somebody who gets off the bus at Locust Grove may have somebody next door who works for somebody who has their own cleaning business. And the attitude and outlook may be somewhat different. And so that may put a different mindset and feeling in you. And so I just wonder if that may be lead you to a different tier and path on where you might be able to end up.
That's my sense, that, you know, young people look around them. They look around them to see, you know, who are their role models? What are the things that they can learn? What are the paths that they can go? And if they don't see something, they don't know it's there.
Lyle Sola Yates here, Charlottesville Planning Commission. Again, as I did some of my work for today's show, Payne's Mill with Southern Development?
By right, low density, single family detached subdivision in the south part of town.
My understanding is that don't all new projects, don't they have to have a certain number of low cost homes?
This is a common misconception. Virginia gives very few rights to localities like Charlottesville to provide for affordable homes. We have very limited tools. We can demand that for what's called a special use permit. Basically, if a developer comes to the city asking for, you know, special permission to build more homes or to get more height, or for some other, you know, sort of substantive change, then we can ask for, I think, a maximum of 15% affordable housing. But if they don't, we can't. They do what they want.
How about, can Charlottesville rewrite any rules to encourage more affordable units? I mean, many people would say Charlottesville needs more low-cost housing. Even the townhouses and condos are not low-cost.
I would be one of them. So there's a few things we can do, and we're doing everything, which is, I think, is the right approach. So one is to just permit more housing. If we permit more housing, housing costs should not continue to increase as fast. That doesn't save everybody. That doesn't solve the problem. It just keeps it from getting worse. Second, we can do what we've got now, which is the 15%. The problem with that is that developers can pay a fee instead of providing housing, and that's cheaper. So mainly they do that. So we get a lot of money, but we don't get much housing. We're starting to see some projects from that, but it's just not enough. It's a drop in the bucket. A third thing we can do is we can build more subsidized housing. We have, West Haven is an example, we have subsidized housing, government-owned. We also have nonprofit-run housing like Friendship Court, where people who are low-income can apply, they can get in. The waiting lists are too long. It takes years to get a home, and those can be hard years if you qualify. But it's something, and we can do more of that.
I'm curious about organizations that are looking for the Planning Commission to do things. Was there a major success or a major change or anything that happened over the summer by the Planning Commission?
We've had a lot of big changes. It's been a big year for us. Having the housing needs assessment in hand was absolutely huge. Having a specific number, we're trying to get to about 4,000 affordable homes. We're, I think, 3,600 in the red right now. So once we catch up, we'll be in better shape. Having that information in hand and turning that into a clear plan for an affordable housing strategy, that's fairly new. And we have that, and it looks like council supports that, which is very, very encouraging. My sense is that council understands the problem and is willing to address it. I'm hearing the same thing from the city manager, Mike Murphy. We had a lot of question marks coming into this year, and we have more exclamation marks now, which I think is good.
I asked that because I found one of those organizations that is really strong for more of the type of housing that you're for, pleading for more efforts for the Planning Commission to do this type of work. And then over the summer, their website sort of stopped doing its thing, and I didn't know if that was because they dried up or they got what they wanted.
Well, certainly the Planning Commission has talked about affordable housing in a very different way. We had a joint meeting with the Housing Advisory Committee, which I also sit on, going over the housing needs assessment, really understanding the really terrible news. But it's good to get terrible news, then you can move forward. I think that was very sobering for us and grounding. We had to discard a lot of bad ideas that we had been committed to over the previous 10 years and really reorient. And I think that sent a good message to a lot of people who are concerned about these issues.
Lyle Sola Yates here with us. A few minutes left. Mr. Sola Yates, Charlottesville Planning Commission, as we talk about city neighborhoods and poverty. It looks like that affordable housing is almost not to be found in the northern areas of the city. Is that go back to history and just the way the city was built at the time?
Yes, that goes back to the original 1929 zoning, which really focused wealth in the northern part of the city around the segregated McIntyre Park. And the thought was that the south side of the tracks would really be the more affordable area. That's where duplexes were permitted. The idea being two cities, a rich city and a poor city.
How does UVA play a role in, I mean, we talked about the hotels, the question I asked, but UVA certainly must play a role because of its expansion, certainly buying pieces of property. I know that in the Venable neighborhood, many beautiful homes being purchased, whether they're purchased by businesses, whether they're purchased by out-of-town landlords, et cetera. Talk about that for a minute.
UVA is the elephant in the room. There, they've been enormously influential at every step of the way. At any time you look at the history of housing in Charlottesville, UVA is casting a big shadow. Going back to UVA support of segregated country club at Farmington, trying to create a sort of privileged space safe from African Americans, or going up to the destruction of all of the neighborhoods around the UVA hospital, Gospel Hill, just gone, completely gone. The Canada on JPA gone. The and it's just pressure. As UVA grows, Charlottesville shrinks. Our tax base dries up, and we have less space to provide for the needs of our citizens.
How does a Charlottesville citizen participate in and with the Charlottesville Planning Commission?
Well, we have public meetings in there. People are welcome to come out. We also broadcast them on the internet. We have pretty regular surveys. The big one is going to be this coming city council meeting presenting the new comprehensive plan. Participation in that is very welcome. This current comprehensive plan is our most representative we've ever done. We did four rounds of public engagement, which is unheard of. Other communities are studying what we do. So we take public participation very seriously.
Can I ask, we've talked about city neighborhoods and poverty and the differentiation in class and race. Charlottesville Planning Commission, are there any folks of lower class on the commission? And I realize that may be difficult without naming names. I'm not asking for that. Does the Planning Commission have a percentage, the same percentage of race on the commission that there is in the city?
Racially, we're pretty similar. Income? No, we are a wealthy group. We're doing very well. The people who are selected for the Planning Commission know something about urban planning. You know, they have some special knowledge that most citizens won't have, and that creates an income bias. And that's a problem. We have to sort of set aside our class interests and think more broadly. It's work.
Can you be like the UVA's Board of Visitors and have that person in the back, you know, like they have the student member, and have somebody in the back who may be a lower income without that graduate degree, and say, we're really interested in your opinion?
I think that's a great idea.
Heard it here first, folks. Next week, David Toscano will be our guest. I hope you'll tune in there here for that show as well. Lyle Sola-Yate, Charlottesville Planning Commission, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.